Yeah, I think we could get started. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Monday, November 21st, 2016 meeting of the Executive Committee of the Board of Directors of the Bay Area Air Quality Management District. Our clerk is Ms. Marcy Hrotzka. Could you please give us the roll call?
On the roll for the Executive Committee meeting of November 21st, 2016, Director Joya.
Here.
Director Groom.
Present.
Director Haggerty.
Yeah.
Director Hudson. Director Pepper. Director Ross.
Yeah.
Director Wagenknecht.
Yeah.
Vice Chair Nis. Chair Marr.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. And I think, Director Hudson is here, so he should be here any minute. Let's have the Pledge of Allegiance. Please join us in saying the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands. One nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. Item number two is public comment on non-agenda matters. Are there any cards, Ms. Hrotzka?
Not for this item.
Okay. And I see no one coming to the microphone, so let's close public comment. Item three, approval of minutes of September 19th, 2016. So it's been moved by Haggerty, seconded by Hudson. Can we approve them without objection, colleagues? Thank you. Next item, Ms. Hrotzka, number four, Bay Area Regional Collaborative update.
Yes, good morning, Chair Marr, and members of the Executive Committee. We have with us this morning Allison Brooks, who will give a presentation on an update on the BARC activities.
Thank you, Ms. Brooks.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair and Board of Directors. I'm delighted to be here. Friday, we just had the BARC Governing Board meeting, and I don't have a PowerPoint for you today. I'm just going to provide some talking points. We had a presentation by Laura Tam at SPUR on a report called Fossil Free Bay Area, which I think syncs up really nicely with some of the work that, a lot of the work that the Air District is doing. And I know as you're all thinking about and completing the Clean Air Plan and the Climate Protection Strategy, it outlines some useful actions that can be done. And I think we've that was very useful and used a lot of information from the Air District. We also, in terms of moving forward, we will be nominating a new chair. Supervisor Haggerty will be completing his two-year term as chair of BARC, which has been great to have his leadership on that. And we will, related to the Clean Air Plan and the Climate Protection Strategy, we're in partnership with the Air District staff and BayREN, the Bay Area Regional Energy Network, and the California Energy Commission on a work around helping cities and jurisdictions across the Bay adopt solar ordinances. And we hope that will be an entry point to take on other REACH codes and ordinances that support climate strategies at the local level. And working together, which is exciting, across agencies, to provide that support to local jurisdictions, I think will be a good model moving forward to help achieve some of our goals. We also are launching a Caltrans grant. It's the largest received in the state for planning around sea level rise. That's a partnership between BARC, MTC, and BCDC. And we'll be starting that. It just was approved, and we'll be launching that very soon. We're completing some of the contracting. We'll release an RF, a request for qualifications for consultant support, hopefully in December. And we'll shortly, I think I almost can announce it, that we have support from a national foundation to support the Resilient by Design Challenge, which will be a bringing in international design teams across the Bay Area in 10, up to 10, I think it will be 10 communities around the Bay to address resiliency and the co-benefits that could be created through creating greater resiliency in our communities. And that will also be starting in early 2017. And we're thinking ahead. BARC just completed its two-year work plan from 2015 to 2017, and we're working together with Mr. Broadbent and Ms. Roggenkamp and the other leadership from the other agencies to think through how BARC can continue to support the work of the agencies and the work of the agencies working together. And, and that's will be featured in the work plan A big one is, you know, many of the agencies are releasing really important, significant reports in 2017. The Clean Air Plan, the Climate Protection Strategy, Plan Bay Area. How can we make sure that we're communicating those effectively and showing that cross-coordination across the agencies and showing the intersection between all of these plans and how they relate to each other and how they support the work we're doing as a region and in our local communities. So that will be coming ahead at the February meeting. We'll have a draft of that, along with a presentation by the Air District on the Clean Air Plan and the Climate Protection Strategy. So I'll leave it there if you have any questions for me.
Actually, I'll just raise one. I know when President Trump enters office January 20th, there's 100 days, there's pretty ambitious efforts to roll back a lot of the climate change progress, cut money to the UN climate change stuff. But I'm just wondering what the analysis on resilience and the work that BARC is doing entering into the new administration, if you have any predictions. How will it impact our work?
Well, Chair Moore,
as soon as you do your predictions, we're going to Vegas and put some bets down, okay, Allison?
Investing poll.
If only I had some predictions. Well, they're very dire predictions. Every day I wake up and my prediction is that as leadership here in the Bay Area, we need to show the way, and in California, we need to show the way how we can create resiliency and a stronger economy and support inclusion and diversity. And I think we're doing that, and we need to stay strong and continue to support that work. So I don't see a lot, who they're appointing as the EPA. So far, who he's thrown out there have not been very supportive of resiliency or even accepting that climate change is an issue. So,
thank you, Ms.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks. So no questions. Let's open this up for public comment. Is there anyone from the public that would like to speak? Public comment is closed. Item 5, Ms. Rotzka, update of remote participation protocol for committee meetings.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the Executive Committee. This item is in regards to revisiting the protocols for remotely participating in meetings here in 375 Beale. Now that we've moved in, we're in the process of evaluating, essentially establishing the appropriate technology for this facility. And a number of board members have asked me about how we're going to govern ourselves with regard to having board members participate remotely. And so we thought what one we can do is give you an update of this effort, also revisit the protocols, make sure we're all on the same page as we move forward to establish the technology in this building. John Giladakis is going to be giving you our, on behalf of the district staff, an update on this item, and we'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Marr and members of the Executive Committee. Specifically, we plan to provide an update to on plans to add video conferencing technology to this conference room that will allow for remote participation at remote conference centers, predefined remote conference centers, where both members of the community and board members can attend remotely during committee meetings. Now, you may recall that we had a flavor of this technology in our old building at 939 Ellis Street, and we had set it up to allow for remote public meetings at both Santa Rosa Junior College and San Jose State University. We tested it at both facilities. We only ever used it at Santa Rosa Junior College, however. We only had it available in the fourth floor conference room. If you might recall, it was that wood paneled room on the fourth floor, kind of dark room. And it wasn't in the boardroom. It was kind of low quality. There was a lot of panning and kind of grainy images that went back and forth. Here at 375 Beale, we plan to add it to the boardroom and also to the Yerba Buena conference room next door. It allows for a much higher quality. It will allow for a much higher quality of audio and video conferencing. And it will also be available to feed into the webcast, so the remote images from the remote conference will be able to be switched onto the video stream that goes out for webcasting. Now, due to the complexity of this room, you can sort of peek through that window. Things have gotten a lot more complicated these days. We decided early on to add this feature as a second phase, and the shared services organization here in the building is actually taking the lead on the project. I do have a representative from the Shared Services Organization here today, Nick Rathel, who's available to answer any more specific technical questions on the project. The project is slated for installation here in the first quarter of 2017. Now, we had established some protocols back at 939 Ellis, and we just wanted to remind the board of the protocols we had established. We had decided to use the technology for committee meetings only, not for full board meetings. We decided not to use the technology when action items or votes were agendized. We wanted to note that Brown Act noticing is required at the remote locations where we have designated the video conference setup. And also, through experience, we found that administrative support is necessary at the remote locations. We need to have staff there to help manage the location. That's a conclusion of the presentation. Is there any questions or discussion?
Question. So I guess the issue is whether we're going to revisit any of these rules, the protocols today, right? That's really sort of our discussion. But just to be clear, the current policy has been not to utilize it for action items, but just at committee meetings.
That's correct.
But no action. Can we go back to the locations again? We had talked about some other locations. So these are the current locations we have: Santa Rosa Junior College and San Jose State. And are these locations available every time we want to do a remote? Because we need certainty.
Yeah, we do need to reserve them in advance. I'm not sure what the advance notification is, but we reserve them in advance. We pay a use fee.
Right.
They certainly could be scheduled in with our board presentations.
And we had talked about trying to find a location in the East Bay, probably east side of the hills, just because if you're on the west side of the hills, you're closer to San Francisco. So it's more on the Scott Haggerty, Mark Ross, Dave Hudson side of the hills, I guess you could say. I'm on the good side of the hills.
Yeah, we'd be happy to take that as an action item.
Yeah. So, and then, and the idea is we would also have public participate as well, since we have this there. We would have rules for the public and board members. So just as a comment, it seems that we need a location in the hinterlands of the East Bay, and then we also need some certainty so that people aren't going to different locations, and if they're available, they're always available.
No, that's correct, Director Joya. And just because of the Brown Act, you're going to have to allow for public to actually utilize these facilities and comment from those
right,
remote,
exactly.
Locations as well.
Thank you. Director Haggerty and Director Groom.
Thank you. Could you please go to the slide, I think roll to the next one. Next one. Well, it's the first for me that I've ever seen can't be used for action items. The only thing I've ever known is that action items require a roll call vote under the Brown Act.
Right. Dr. Haggerty mentioned where this is coming from. When we've discussed it with you before, you all have said we want to be able to look you in the eye and have a conversation if indeed there is an important decision.
That is actually my quote.
I don't mean to do that to you, but...
No, that's fine.
That's where that comes from. And so we tried to say, okay, well, that's for action items then.
So that's our rule. That's not the Brown Act.
No.
That's
okay.
Right.
Because I really believe, and I'll just say this again, I don't support this for board members. And this is just my opinion. I don't think board members should be able... I think board members need to come to the meetings. I thoroughly believe that. And I do believe if, in fact, they don't come to the meetings. ABAG, for example, has a two-tier stipend where if you come in on video conferencing or if you come in on the phone, you get a lesser stipend. And I think we should consider that if we're going to do this. It's a two-tiered stipend. So, but I don't believe board members should be allowed to do that. And I think that, I think it's all right for the public to be able to come in and let me just go back, because I think it's too unruly with board members trying to come in and out. And we have this problem sometimes at our Board of Supervisors meetings where they jump in and they interrupt the meetings. We've had a taste of it at our own meeting where we've had a certain director that all of a sudden just jumps in and starts talking and interrupts the meeting when it was on the phone, I believe. I think she was on the phone. It's very disruptive. So I think from my standpoint, me speaking, I absolutely do not support this for the Board of Directors. I think the Board of Directors have to come in. Now, if we want to utilize this for the public, I'm fine with that. Because the public is in a public comment period, and we can line them up, and we can say, okay, now we're going to go to the San Jose State facility. Please line up. Use your comment. Now's your time to speak. You give them their 1, 2, 3 minutes to speak. They come up, speak. We can see them on the screen. We can hear their comments, and we can run right through them because we have a staff member there, and they're keeping track of the time. And that allows the public to give the input. In my opinion, that is the reason for the video conferencing, is to make us more accessible to the public. Mm-hmm. But I think if I'm going to lose this battle, and believe me, I come from Dublin. I have to get up and be ready and be on the road and plan 2.5 hours to get here to San Francisco. So I'm one of the furthest now. So it takes me 2.5 hours, and I'm willing to make that commitment to come in here. I use a plug-in hybrid to get here, so I'm doing the right thing. But I just think the board members have to be here. And if I do lose that battle, I really believe we need to consider the two-tiered stipend.
Thank you, Director Groom, then Director Ross, and then back to Joya.
Thank you, Chair Moore. I'm curious of what the frequency of the use of these remote locations. I can't really recall too many meetings where there's somebody on the phone or on the video, but how often?
John, what?
Thank you. In the old facility, we used the meeting room a total of 4 times.
4 times. Yeah. Over a couple-year period? 3-year period we've had this going now?
3 to 4 years.
Okay. And what is the cost? I remember when we put it in, at the time it seemed pretty exorbitant.
It's around $68,000 to included for this room and the other room over there.
A year?
No, that's a one-time cost, one-time? And then the meetings themselves are charged back to us. The cost is, I think, around $1,000 or so.
Okay. You know, I understand the need to have people have remote locations in case they cannot get here. I get that completely. But I do agree with Director Haggerty, and I think I said this at the same time. I think the Board of Directors ought to be present, and they ought to cast their votes in real time at the real meeting. So how many members of the public have been to use the spaces? Do we know?
Just a few, I
right.
think.
There were times in which, in the old building, when it was available, yep. people would actually avail themselves of, okay. Of the facility.
Yeah.
Can we just kind of keep a running tab for a while? When used, who uses it, amount, so that maybe we can reevaluate this? That's a lot of money. And I don't, in no way do I think that we should have the public not have an available location. But I think we need to look at the dollar amount and see exactly who's using it and when they're using it.
Thank you, Director Ross. And then I'm going to go Wagon Connect Hudson, then back to Joya.
Thank you, Chair Moore. I too have some torn feelings about it. On the one hand, we do need to remember that we asked the public on Spare the Air days to not drive, and we have instances where we're asking people to reduce their driving every day, not just spare the air on one day, but spare the air every day. And so trying to reduce the amount of vehicle miles traveled is a concern of us. We have to provide by, and we have to lead by example. I totally agree with Directors Groom and Haggerty. In my old world thinking, it's much better for you to be accountable and present, and as Mr. Director Haggerty says, look people in the eye when you're making your comments or voting. I do understand he's got 2.5 hours. I booked 2 hours to come in my hybrid, and unless I take BART, which is problematic. So I would say that we do have some options before us that we aren't considering. One is in Walnut Creek, there's a place called Third Workplace, and I can't imagine it's the only one in the Bay Area. It's right near the BART, Pleasant Hill BART station, right near the transit. And it's just an office space that you come in and you can rent a space, a computer. It's called Third Workplace, and it's just they have conference rooms. They have a person sitting at the front desk who is a concierge of sorts who could direct you to a video conference room and could post the meeting agendas. Nobody has to go out there, and it seems rather cheap. I mean, you could probably do this for less than $100 a meeting. Maybe, and I'm just wildly guessing it's that, because I think the rooms rent for $10 an hour, and what they charge to post something on the window would be, and it's right near transit. There's probably others around the other similar facilities, commercial facilities around the Bay Area, and I think that would be accessible for the public. We can certainly manage as we go around for the public comment, and I think we could develop a protocol for directors for them to speak only when they are remotely called upon. If you're going to take the easy way out and go to one of these remote locations, well, then you're last in the queue and you have to abide by the rules that we set for the rules of engagements of these meetings. And you can only speak when it's your turn in the rotation. So I don't think that's that much of a protocol we have to develop. I am torn, but I think ultimately in the Bay Area, we're going to have to rely on telecommuting as part of our VMT reduction strategy. And we're going to have to lead by example by providing a pathway that we can use that private companies could emulate and see that it works. So I think we almost have a duty to make it work if we're asking private companies to reduce their travel of their employees. So if we can't do it, then why are we asking companies to modify their commute patterns for their employees if we're not going to do it? Thank you.
Thank you. Director Wagenknecht.
My anticipation is that if we have remote places for the meetings, that we would be part of the, you'd be able to see us on screen as we're there. So you can monitor that we're there most of the time. So that's one part of it. But I think... I wouldn't use those very often. I did that one time because the traffic was, I was never going to make it in, and I turned and made it up to Santa Rosa in time to make the meeting, and so I use it then. But I don't like to do that because I'm not convincing enough in person. If I'm 50 miles away, my poor constituents aren't getting their service out of me and me doing anything for them. But that's a choice that I think that we make as electeds, and our bosses get to make that choice when we've made that type of choice enough times. I'm not wed to just doing committee meetings. If we're going to do it, and you can see us there, and we get it, we have to get in the queue like anybody else. You know, we have people in our meetings that don't pay attention to the chair at times. We just need to enforce this all the way through. Of course, Brown Act, and I'm not. If you're going to be away on action, remote on action items, you're going to lose some of your ability to make your arguments. But that's between you and your bosses on that.
Thank you, Director Hudson.
Yeah, I don't want to repeat the same things you just heard. I think we're all onto something. There's a missing time link in here to put this whole thing together. And I think the way to do it might be to separate the listening to the meetings where people can get the information, and it might be at least in the East Bay. I think San Ramon's new offices are set up for it, and I think Scott can talk to his district. And we're set up where we can get the information out. The next thing is, how do you get people to do the interacting thing? And that's where I start to have a problem. Director Hagerty, Director Marr, and I were at the ABAG meeting, and San Jose chimed in, and I think they were the only no's, and it was, I don't even know why you bothered to do it, because there was, you're not talking anybody into anything on a phone set up out in the middle right here. And we have a lot of people that come in here that want to talk. I mean, it would be very easy to say, you know, if we can send them to San Jose State or up to North Bay or something like that, it might be easier. But it isn't making the point that they want to make. And it goes back to what Scott said. They want to look in the eye. They want to see this. Now, if we have two or three directors at each one of these sites, they may feel like they're getting that same feel. But for now, and this informational item for feedback, I would say focus more on, first of all, getting it out to different areas where people can see what's going on, because they'll write you a letter. If they don't like what's going on, they'll write you a letter. I think it gives us an opportunity to advance the spare of the air, as Mark was saying, and then work on something where the interaction is correct in the protocol, because right now it's just been, you know, over $100,000 for four meetings where somebody might speak, and that really gets to the real problem. Have you ever seen elected officials that can that hold themselves to 2 minutes? I mean, we're the worst offenders of this thing where it drags on. And I just look at the nods. So I think we're going to have a real problem as far as the interaction back. But as far as the listening, I think we could advance and have people that can see what we're doing. And you see 15, 20 people show up at a place, that has some impact.
Let's see. We have Joya and Hagerty, but I wanted to just chime in that I think for the committee meetings, meeting quorums was one of the key goals. And even though votes or action items cannot be cast, it seems like the presence of the regional spots for board members, we could make quorums for the committee meetings, or a remotely participating board member could still help to meet the quorums. Okay. And then I did want to say that I like the idea of the third spot to be investigated near Walnut Creek, or the third workplace sounds good. I actually support video conferencing as a way of increasing that public participation. I'm kind of mixed on the board participation, because if we allow too many regional spots, then board members will stop coming to the general physical spot for our meetings. But I like Carol Groom's idea of monitoring it, because I am concerned about the cost as well. Director Joya.
Yeah, just to add, and I think we're heading in a direction. I do think we can provide leadership for public participation by having three locations, but we need to publicize them and make them regular. We're not going to get participation at these regional sites if we do it there one day and we don't do it there for the next meeting and we don't publicize it. I think we could be the first agency that says we are having these three North, South, East Bay public participation regional centers to allow the public to come, figure that out, whether it's for board meetings or committee meetings. And obviously some committee meetings and some board meetings are going to clearly attract more attention than others. We just know that. You know, we see that people show up at our board meetings or council meetings, depending on what's on the agenda. But we have to be consistent, and we have to market the sites. And I agree with Scott's sort of general philosophy. I've been thinking about this. On a regular basis, we are elected to come together as a body and deliberate. There are rural counties across the state and across this country that hold, people travel far distances every week, every 2 weeks to come to a board meeting, because that's the place that or they'll have two locations where they go in a large county. Scott, you know this, but they go to the meeting personally. And I think, I don't agree with this idea that it's, that we're the same as other employees to telecommute. This is about to reduce GHGs. I get we're developing policies to reduce GHGs. We're doing it in our personal lives, But when we're elected to come here to a meeting, we should be deliberating together and we should be looking at the public, hearing from the public. And I think that respects the public. Now, that's not to say that there won't be occasions where to get a quorum or inconvenience that a board member may need to participate. I think maybe the distinction is we just don't encourage it as a regular thing. In fact, my understanding is already a state law that allows agencies to develop policies to have people phone call in. And I know we've all maybe done that when we've needed a quorum or needed a board member to participate and you have to post it. But I think it's up to the agency to develop a policy. The difference here is ours is a video as opposed to an audio, right, which is better. So maybe that's where we can focus is, you know, one, focus on public participation, make it regular at three consistent locations, and two, figure out, even if it's for an action item now and then, but have it be very irregular where it's absolutely needed by that member because something has happened, but not to encourage it and not to make it regular, because I think then we fall into this idea that, you know, we're not coming together on some regular basis.
Thank you. Director Haggerty?
Well, my mind is wandering, I think. I think mostly, first of all, I think we're going to be criticized. I think if you're going to have the meetings down in San Jose State and you're going to have the meetings, I think the other one was in Sonoma, they're going to ask you, why don't you have it in Richmond? You know, I mean, that's really where a lot of the people are coming from right now. They're not coming from Walnut Creek. And so I think location, I mean, it's just like anything, location, location, location. So I think if you're really going to move forward with this, I mean, the public is going to expect you to analyze where are the people coming from or where do the people really want you to be. They're not going to say, you know, where is it convenient for the directors? They're going to want you to say, where is it convenient for the public? So I think we're going to have to step back and we're going to have to look at, you know, what is convenient for them, not us. So I think there needs to be more work done on that. I think if you're going to go down this road, which I don't want to, I'm going to be clear. The only reason I want to go down this road is for the public. I'm going to be clear. I'm stating the obvious again from Scott Haggerty's world. I don't want to do this for the board of directors, but I just want to be, I want to be very clear. If you're going to do this, I think there's no reason you can't do action items. Okay. You could do action items, but you just need to do a roll call. Okay. So if you do this, there's no reason you can't do action items, but I am going to also be very clear that if you have a director that comes in remotely, which I don't want to do, then the stipend should be half. You should start looking at a two-tiered stipend. That's fallen on deaf ears. Nobody else has commented on it, but I want to
agreed.
Say okay, yep. Nobody else has said that. So I just want to say that again, okay? The other thing is, what started this, the reason why I wanted to be back in the queue a while back, and it's been a while, so the technology may be old, but a while back, CSAC bought every county video conferencing technology. So every county has it, okay? But the other problem is how does the county, if you're going to turn that over to every county and say, hey, can we use your technology, how do you manage that with the county? All of a sudden, if you know, are you going to use their boardroom every, what is today, Monday? Well, my boardroom may be being used right now. I don't know if health committee is in there. I don't know if social service committee is in there, but I don't know how you manage that. But, you know, the technology is there. Now, Mark just showed me, I don't know if you're in the queue, but workplace is everywhere. One workplace is everywhere. So you can put it out to the private companies, but the public sector has this technology too. So I just think there needs to be a lot more work based on what I just said. But it's not where it's convenient for us. It's where it's convenient for the public. And you need to do a lot more work on that.
Thank you. Director Ross?
I agree with
that. Did I steal your thunder on that? I'm sorry.
No. You know, I agree with everything. I agree with everything he says. Director Haggerty said that we should be able to vote on action items. And by the way, they're committee meetings, so they're going to have to vote on them when they come to the board anyway. So that's where they can vote on them in person and look people in the eye. And yes, they should probably get a substantial sum less than what they get if they come in. And then the rest of the directors that did drive in can split the difference. Yeah. Well, maybe not. As a bonus, maybe, for showing up. But again, you know, this casual car, Bay Area started casual carpooling. And we could start, and we see everybody, if you go into Starbucks, half the people there or more are working. And what we can do, I mean, this one place in San Francisco that was called Third Workplace, it closed. It was on King Street. Apparently, that location is closed. The one in Walnut Creek is still open. But there should be, I can see the Bay Area kind of fostering a way of commuting, a way of working, where you report to one of these third remote areas instead of having to drive in. They don't have to rent as much space to accommodate all the workers. And if you have a flex schedule, you can. This is kind of an interim thing. So I think if we provide a blueprint, it doesn't have to necessarily work perfectly for us, but if we can design a blueprint for the Bay Area, it would reduce VMTs. I think telecommuting is vastly underestimated as a potential in the Bay Area for reducing greenhouse gases. And it's actually going on now more than we think it is. It just hasn't been formalized. I mean, just look at all the people in any coffee shop you go to. They're using those areas as workplaces. And I think that we could formalize it so companies would feel comfortable using it, and democracy should feel comfortable trying to lead the way that way, especially in the Bay Area, because driving in here is driving into San Francisco. It's a duty for us, but it's a calling for the public, and for them to have to come all the way down to 375 Beale, it is, you have to have a strong sense of calling to do it. So, beautiful building, just terrible location. Thanks.
Mr. Chiladakis, are there any other comments? Yeah, Mr. Bunger.
Yeah, you know, I take Director Ross's comments about there being the availability of these private sector facilities, but I wanted to remind the board that when we went to set this up before, we looked at public sector locations for a variety of reasons, not least of which is the Brown Act requires that everywhere we have this is publicly accessible, also ADA compliant. There are staff there who understand what a public meeting is and how it's supposed to be run. We don't have to send a staff person to some of these locations because they have staff on site that can handle it for us. And so for those reasons, among many others, we selected only public sector spaces. We can do a little more looking at this, but my recommendation in order to be clear that we're going to be compliant on all the things we have to be compliant on is that we stick with that protocol rolling forward.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chiladakis, mm-hmm. you have a number John, of pieces what? Of suggestions from the board. Oh, go ahead, Mr. Bloodbent.
So, John, let me go ahead and I'll summarize it. So, Mr. Chairman, let me summarize what we'll take back as direction. How about that? And I should have mentioned as part of our presentation, I don't know if this is of any interest to you, but South Coast and San Joaquin Air Districts have been doing this for literally many, many, many years. And it's largely because of the traffic down there. They have a hard time getting to Diamond Bar. So that being said, let us take it back. We need to, I think, refine this further. We do believe, though, that what I'm hearing is that you all are interested in being able to set up these remote locations largely to help serve the public. And so we'll, with that in mind, we're going to go back and find another location in the East Bay. We're also going to see how this goes. I think it's one of these things where you kind of have to roll it out. See
go,
how it goes
go ahead,
next
Joya.
Year.
When we said East Bay, I want to make sure. I think Walnut Creek is not as convenient to both counties. I'm thinking you're going to want to look at more of the San Ramon Valley to cover Alameda and Contra Costa if you were looking like the San Ramon area in that corridor.
Director Hudson?
Yeah, I don't have a problem with doing more than three if you're looking at you bifurcate these two problems. One is interaction, one is seeing the meetings. Let me finish, John, before you get crazy over there. If you start
I just off, mean start incrementally.
Yeah, I'm on the same page with that. You start off by where you can show the meetings and the interest can be generated and people start to see it while you're working towards the two-way conferencing. I'll give you an example. In our city hall, it's only been there since May. Sound familiar? I had them put up a screen so that people could see things like this in the future, and they put up an information booth right next to it. And there is no reason we shouldn't be running meetings like this for people to see. Mm-hmm. Then from there, you decide whether or not you could do it. That's just one place. I concur completely with what you're hearing. I think the workplace you're talking about is nice, Mark, but you got to have somebody there that, wait a minute, I don't like that, and they want to start yelling, screaming, how do I send letters, and they have a little bit of an understanding so that there's some kind of staff there. I don't have a problem if you're just running out the feed to show people what these meetings are initially at Walnut Creek, at Richmond, at San Ramon, and then decide which one. I mean, that's kind of what BART did, didn't they? BART to the airport, they started off with the Dublin line and then realized they had more from Pitt. You find out what you've got, right? Because you're not ready to do both ways yet.
So, Jack, please continue.
Well, so actually the technology, Director Hudson, is available such that we can make it two-way. I mean, that's available. That's what we're proposing, is that we're incrementally actually roll this out. And we're going to also really only conduct it for a few meetings next year with informational items. And the ones that come to mind are the Climate Protection Committee meeting. There's a lot of information that's displayed. My experience has been with that committee. We oftentimes find ourselves being able to inform the committee, let them know what's going on, but they don't necessarily take an action. Now, that is going to change as we start to engage ourselves in some rulemaking, but I think there's going to be a little bit more time before that happens. And so, Mr. Chairman, that's how I'd like to see it rolled out. And I'll bring it back to the retreat that we'll conduct in January. That'll give us enough time to fine-tune this and bring back some more laid out exact plan for you to consider.
Thank you. It sounds great. Mr. Chilidakis, can you, I know this room is video conferenced. What's the other rooms that we have that we could do video conferencing in this building?
The multipurpose, yeah.
Right, so the room next door, the multipurpose room, it will be set up for video conferencing
as well. So
that's
the room this way?
That way, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much for the presentation and the summary, Mr. Broadbent. Next item, clean air plan, regional climate protection strategy update.
Yes, Chair Maher and committee members. Henry Hilken, our Director of Planning and Climate Protection, will give you an update on our development of the Clean Air Plan and Regional Climate Protection Strategy.
Thank you, Mr. Hilken.
Good morning, Chair Maher and members of the Executive Committee. I'd like to give you an update on our planning process. We updated this committee last spring. We updated the Climate Protection Committee at their September meeting, and before we all sort of calm down for the holidays, we wanted to update this committee on our progress because we will be releasing soon the draft clean air plan, and we wanted to make sure the executive committee was fully briefed. So we find ourselves, staff believes that really our leadership is more critical than ever. California and the Bay Area have really been at the forefront of climate planning. I think, Chair Maher, this is really maybe responding to the comments that you made in the previous item. California and the Bay Area have been at the lead in developing innovative technology, innovative ideas that percolate throughout the country and indeed throughout the world. And we have yet to see exactly what the incoming administration will do, but I think it's safe to say that their emphasis on climate will be much less, and that the activities by regions like the Bay Area and by the state of California are going to be absolutely critical. They'll be more important than ever. So it's very timely that we are updating this clean air plan. Just as a reminder, this is an update to our 2010 clean air plan. That was our last plan. As we did in 2010, it is a multi-pollutant plan. So it is outlining programs and activities to reduce ozone precursor emissions, to reduce fine particle emissions, to reduce emissions and exposure to air toxics, and then to reduce greenhouse gases and to make progress towards long-range climate stabilization goals that the board has articulated in your climate protection resolution to set a goal for the Bay Area 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. And that's, of course, is consistent with the state's long-term goals. We will also be presenting in the Clean Air Plan a midterm goal of 40% below 1990 levels by 2030, which, again, the climate protection resolution that the board adopted did call for a midterm goal, and of course the state of California has similarly set that 2030 goal. So we're harmonizing with the state's goals there. This plan will serve as a strategic plan for our activities in the near term. As all of our clean air plans do, this one will once again lay out a menu of rules and other programs that we implement to reduce pollution and reduce climate pollutants. But in addition, we will be setting a longer range vision. Where does this region need to be in 2050 to achieve our longer term goals with both with respect to air pollution and health, but probably more challenging and more importantly with respect to climate protection? And I'll pick up on this again in just a moment.
Director Ross, did you have a...
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Good?
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So since, as I mentioned, we briefed this committee last spring, we briefed the climate committee back in September, we have been very busy. There has been a huge amount of work going on in Sacramento. There are so many important state strategies and documents. The short-lived climate pollutant strategy, the Sustainable Freight Action Plan, the mobile source strategy, and the SIP strategy, laying out strategies to reduce criteria pollutants to meet long-range air pollution goals, but also climate goals. Perhaps most important is the scoping plan update. The ARB is currently preparing another update to the AB 32 scoping plan that will outline a strategy to reach the state's 2030 goals. We expect that to come out any week now, by the end of the year. And that is, needless to say, is an extremely vitally important document for the state, and that we will be looking at very closely as we refine, as we take the draft clean air plan and bring it a final to you later, early next year. And so the plan will, as I said, we've identified a short-term control strategy that sort of outlines our strategic programs for the next few years, and then outlines that longer-range strategy that will inform our activities over the longer term. So a little bit more about that. What does that look like? What are some of the longer-term goals that we're going to be articulating and proposing to you in the plan? Well, look at the buildings that we live in. The buildings that we live in and work in, they need to be nearly fossil-free in 2050, get the fossil fuels out of our energy system. They need to be located near transit or walking or bicycle facilities so that we have options from besides driving alone. We need to continue our wood burning efforts and eliminate wood burning in our buildings, in our residential areas. How we get around. You, I think, are certainly well aware that we have been emphasizing electric vehicles in our grant programs and many of our other outreach and programs on transportation. By 2050, we need to see nearly all of our vehicle fleet converted to electric vehicles. The diesel fleet, at least half, if not more, using renewable diesel. Significant reductions in vehicle miles traveled. We have been working closely with ABAG and MTC on Plan Bay Area. They, as I think most of you are aware, will be updating Plan Bay Area and continuing the very important land use and transportation strategies in Plan Bay Area. And those will be ever more important. And so the technology is certainly going to continue to be important, but reducing vehicle miles traveled, reducing vehicle use will be an essential part of those of longer range transportation strategies. The things that we produce need to be lower fossil fuels, pretty much entirely renewable fuels in our energy systems, our electrical grid, and we would need to see our refineries shifting away from processing fossil fuels to clean energy companies, shifting much more towards renewable fuels for our transportation and energy systems. And looking at what we consume as businesses, as individuals, as families and consumers, lower energy intensive diets, a great reduction in waste, and a comprehensive strategy that not only reduces the amount of organic waste that we send to our landfills, but puts that waste to productive use, producing energy. These are just illustrative. It gives us an idea of the types of stretch goals that we're going to need to be working towards over the coming decades. So shifting back to sort of the near-term strategy, again, this plan lays out a menu of programs and activities that we will be implementing in the coming years. this chart really sort of presents it in terms of the different tools that we have at our disposal. And these are our sort of approaches that you've seen many times. Through our grant making, we will continue to focus on the vehicle fleet, but as I've mentioned and as you've heard in the Mobile Source Committee, greater emphasis on electric vehicles and electric vehicle charging infrastructure. A lot of our technical programs are supporting our climate activities and our health activities. We're improving our methane inventory. We have a very robust greenhouse gas measurement program that we've briefed you on that will provide us very helpful information to track our progress and improve our emission inventory. We have a menu of rules that we will be proposing to the board to further reduce risk of air toxics from stationary sources. Next month, you'll be considering amendments to our new source review for toxics rule. Next year, you'll be considering a rule for reducing risk from existing sources. We also in the plan will be identifying a basin-wide methane strategy and a basin-wide combustion strategy to reduce criteria pollutants and GHGs from the stationary sources that we regulate. Through permitting, we have a measure that proposes to reduce the threshold at which greenhouse gases are considered best available controls technology for greenhouse gases is considered in our permitting. Lots and lots of work with local governments. I think the board, the committee may remember that that's been a major focus of our work in the past. It's something that ARB is emphasizing in their scoping plan update, the importance of regional and local actions. That's something that we expect to see highlighted in the scoping plan update. And so we certainly want to double down on all our work supporting the very important work that's being done in the cities and counties in the Bay Area. And similarly, working with our partners here in this building, working with ABAG and MTC to support those local strategies to really develop those land use and transportation strategies to especially to reduce emissions from the transportation sector. So that slide sort of organized the control strategy around the tools at our disposal. This is a different way of looking at it. It sort of presents it in terms of some themes, if you will, that we will be emphasizing. So one thing that we, and you may recall in the past, we've sort of talked about gears, sort of the different sort of organizing principles for the control strategy. So one part of it, of the strategy, really is about reducing emissions from short-lived climate pollutants. To achieve the long-term climate stabilization goals that we're going to need to meet, that's going to require significant reductions in carbon dioxide and a major change in how our energy is produced. And that will be very challenging for us. In the near term, we think that there's going to be, are a lot of opportunities to reduce the short-lived climate pollutants in the near term. There are significant reductions to be had. They are very powerful climate forcers. And this will give us some early reductions while we tackle the more challenging problem of taking fossil fuels out of our economy. And I think these are themes that you're seeing from coming from the Air Resources Board, their emphasis on the short-lived climate pollutant strategy, and the scoping plan also places sort of an early emphasis on these short-lived climate pollutants. So at the same time, we need to reduce the amount, our use of fossil fuels. So as I've mentioned at the previous slide, working with local governments to improve energy efficiency, electrification, reducing VMT, and then getting fossil fuels out of the energy system. So again, some of these are points that I made on the previous slide, the basin-wide combustion strategy, a range of activities with the cities and counties to reduce fossil fuel use in our buildings and improve energy efficiency in buildings, EVs, community choice energy, and so forth. So to date, we have been busy as we have been preparing this plan. We have also been implementing some of these programs. We have implemented the GHG measurement network that is in place, and it's recording data. It's on our website. We are now also deploying a research van that can go to individual sources and do greenhouse gas measurements. Last week, we updated the Climate Committee on a very exciting project we have been involved in to develop solar energy master plans for public schools in the Bay Area that has had some very positive outcomes that we're really excited about, and we hope to continue. We've had some excellent results in the first phase, and I think the Climate Committee last week was very interested, and so I hope we can continue that. We have developed a tool with MTC to provide data to local planners. It's a little boring and wonky, but let me tell you, when we talk to local staff, getting consistent, reliable data for their greenhouse gas inventories is something we hear again and again. And so that's something that we and MTC staff have felt is very important for local planners. And as you may recall, the Mobile Source Committee and the Board of Directors have really focused a lot of funds towards our electric vehicle programs. And then a number of programs that are underway. As Allison mentioned in her BARC update, we are participating with BARC and BayREN and others on the solar energy, the solar ordinance project. It's one of the best practices. It's an example of one of the best practices that we can support local governments on. Rulemaking that you're familiar with on the oil and gas wells, natural gas distribution, the risk rules that I've mentioned, and the wood smoke program that I think the board is, the committee is pretty familiar with, and we'll be updating you on our wood program at the next full board meeting. How did we get here? We have had lots of meetings, let me tell you. We have had two rounds of open houses and workshops where we sort of take our show on the road and have the sort of traditional meetings in public facilities throughout the region. We've moved more towards an open house format that has allowed more dialogue with stakeholders. We've also had technical work group meetings with stakeholders and subject matter experts to help provide maybe a little more technical input on our control strategy. Lots and lots and lots of one-on-one meetings with stakeholders and industry groups, community groups, and so forth. This past summer, we had a review and public comment opportunity for the draft control strategy. We've been experimenting with some new tools, like as I mentioned, the open house format. Open Air Forum is an online tool that we've developed. It's just a different way of allowing the public to provide input online. Lots of regular reports to the board, various committees. And where we go next. Later this year, we expect to have, before the holidays, we'll be releasing the draft plan and the EIR on the plan for public review. We expect to have another round of public meetings in the early part of the year, January, and then would bring the final proposed plan to the Board of Directors in March, probably in April. That concludes my presentation, Mr. Chair. I can answer any questions.
Thank you, Director Gioia.
So I think this is a really good outline. I just had a couple comments. At the Air Resources Board meeting last week, one of the things I really strongly urged the Air Board staff to do was to be as detailed as possible in the suite of measures that local air districts and local government could adopt to help achieve the 2030 goal. And it may be that all those details aren't as much in this first draft, but could be in the second draft. I think so ARB was intending to sort of talk about local action, and I think we all know that the more there's detail, the more helpful it is, and then to try to estimate the range of GHG reduction that would occur. So I think, and I know you talk a lot about 2050, and Brad and I were just sort of having a side conversation about, you know, the 2050 goal, we don't yet know how we're going to get to 2050. I think we're going to see a path to 2030. So I think you should continue to elevate that 2030 midterm goal, because that's where the action is going to be happening over the next 10 years, is I think we know it's possible to reach this 2030 goal. And so hopefully the AB 32 scoping plan will lay out some details. I do think also, and this is really more maybe for how people perceive what we're doing, but I think is important. On your first slide, you talk about incubating innovation, serving as model, and so forth. I think we have to continually respond to those that say, so why is the Bay Area or California, in this case, you know, those of us here at the Bay Area, why are we doing this? It's only a small drop in the bucket. And I think there are three important things we need to say. And you sort of said two of them here. Okay. One is serving as that what we're doing, one serves as a model for other regions, but as part of that, it's scalable, right? I mean, the whole idea is what we're doing here is should be scalable up to a state or national level. So I think that's an important concept. Second, this incubating innovation, which is, right, that we're trying to change technology. And that, that's what's happening in California. The technology is being pushed, and that's being adopted even outside the state. So I think focusing on that whole technology change, driving technology change. And third, I think we should always continue to list up front achieving co-benefits. Because to the public, they're saying, okay, well, those that, you know, aren't as on board, well, what's the benefit to us today? Well, there are co-benefits. There's either energy efficiency, cost savings, improved air quality, improved health. So I think those three things seem to me always important to keep up front about when we're pursuing our plan, right? It's like they're just and then focus on 2030 as well, because that's really achievable and there's going to be some specifics on that.
Thank you. Director Wagenknecht, and then Director Hudson.
Well, I want to reinforce the idea of the data for local planners. That's a viable product that I think my planners need. So thank you for that, and I want to reinforce that. You talk about wood burning, and in there it was kind of like it was all the residential wood burning. We have agricultural and commercial wood burning and we might look at those. It makes no sense to our residential customers that we're telling them to not burn, but then we're allowing these large sources. I know it may be apples and oranges, but we have to make it clear, you know, here's what's going on and here's why, and maybe come up with another plan. And it'd be interesting. You kind of went to a roundup of the new rules, but it'd be interesting to see what you're looking at as possible new rules to come up. Just kind of a listing of them, even the brainstormed list of them at this point.
Director Hudson.
Yeah, I also like the report, and I don't want to repeat what you've just heard, but I think it was slide 4 and 5 where I first entertained the question that you said the scoping plan was coming. I always ask the same question every time I see the scoping plan is, can I see the reforestation protocol? And mainly because the technology I think we're going to be looking at will lead or lean towards carbon sequestration. I mean, for many years we would go to these panels that we're talking about, but I don't see anything going that way. And the reforestation protocol would tell you which reductions in the carbon dioxide you're getting from which tree, which age, that kind of stuff. And I will tell you, my city's alone is talking about changing 5,000 trees out of 12,000 in Doherty Valley. They want to take a start-over approach, and they need to understand what they're really doing. And there's probably a like number on the west side of the hills. The next thing, and I didn't see it anywhere in this discussion, and I keep getting the feeling that maybe it's not as good as it was trumped up to be. Are we dealing with hydrogen at all? I got a hydrogen refueling coming into my city, and I will tell you, at League of California Cities, it was one of the most prominent. Everybody stopped at the Toyota's plan for reforestation, but refueling with hydrogen.
Thank you. We have Director Haggerty, then Director Ross.
Thank you. Jack, as you guys were talking, you had mentioned fleets, and Alameda County just got an award for being one of the cleanest fleets in the world, I think. But it kind of got me thinking about our fleet. And I remember we some time ago turned our fleet over to Enterprise Rent-A-Car. And first question is, are we still doing that?
Yes, we are. Our fleet is 81% alternative fuel.
Okay, you knew where I was going.
Yes.
Define alternative fuel for me.
Natural gas, hybrid electric, plug-in electric, and hydrogen.
So
and full electric, sorry.
And what is? Can you, since you're so ready for this question, can you give me? Can you give me what the breakdown of that is?
I would say that the majority are hybrid electric, a small portion of natural gas, and the second largest component of our fleet would be full electric, full battery.
Yeah, I mean, I realize it's really hard to have our inspectors because of the capability. I mean, I'm sure they do a lot of driving, so I realize it's probably hard to have them all on total electric, but So I guess we're getting there, right?
We are getting there. We're very excited, obviously, about the 200-mile-plus battery electrics that are coming out, hopefully in 2017. But the majority of our fleet is on the hybrid electric side, and we monitor gas mileage, and we're always trying to better and improve our greenhouse gas footprint.
And I guess it's too early to put them on Teslas, right?
We'd like to, but I don't think we would recommend that based on the costs.
Okay, and then just one other quick question. When they go home at night, they plug in?
They have, depending on the vehicle, they do have the ability to plug in at night.
Okay, did we put the plug-in in at their house or what?
Most of the hybrid electric vehicles that we have deployed or the plug-in, they can charge on conventional. So they can charge in 8 hours pretty much from midnight to 8 a.m. On the 11-cent rate, and that's what we encourage them to do.
One time plug. Thank you.
Director Hudson.
I did want to also mention Director Haggerty and all
Director
of you that we have also a hydrogen vehicle that Mr. Breen is driving that I'm going to drive here soon myself. So if you'd like to see it, so it's out in the garage.
What?
Toyota?
Mm-hmm. It's a Mirai.
A hydrogen vehicle.
Hydrogen vehicle.
Correct. Thank you. Director Ross.
Thank you, Chair Mar. I'll just reduce my emissions by being quick. VMT, I'd like to see, you know, casual carpooling and telecommuting, you know, really focused on, because those are areas that really are cost effective and are actually in play now, but they're not really organized, recognized, and gauged as to their efficacy and the dollars we spend to convince the public to reduce their VMT, which then leads to EV charging. Next year, Tesla is coming out with a $35,000 base model. So I expect to see a large increase in that and other models, of course, and our EV infrastructure, even though we have a lot of grants going out there, I think it's still going to be way behind the curve in terms of demand we're already seeing in our town and in our area. Arguments over who's using the charger too much, who's camping out at the charger, and people getting into arguments about that. And we're not really known for being a green area. We're the suburbs, and we try. But if it's happening here, I can imagine it's going to be happening elsewhere. And then in terms of VMT, I don't know how much public information or how much information public agencies could garner from insurance companies, which now track mileage, from Fast Track. I mean, because they have the addresses, maybe there's a way we could blindly get the info, because they have the addresses, they could tell who's going across what bridge in a blind sort of way, so it doesn't invade anybody's privacy, which would help our calculations. And Jack, you had mentioned indirect source. Yeah, our indirect source was mentioned at the last meeting, not by you, but
it was at the BARC meeting.
Yeah, it was at the BARC meeting as a possible way of getting into an even more touchy subject.
Mm-hmm.
And then to get even more touchy, and I'll close with this, if you wanted to reduce carbon, you de-incentivize it, and of course the words carbon tax are just bring joy to everyone. But as a precursor to that, who would administer a carbon tax? Who would collect it? Who has the authority, if there is any authority? So that question, even though we have to debate whether that's something for us, is that if we all said yes, then what? That's it. Thank you.
Good questions. I just wanted to ask Henry and Abby also. I think the work with the school districts on the solar model solar plans is really critical, but I know that we had a Protect Your Climate curriculum for fourth and fifth graders, and I'm just wondering, given the national level potential horrible rollbacks of decades of work at the not just national level but global level now, I'm just wondering how we're going to focus on getting young people to just be the warriors or the science champions of the future too. Is the curriculum still being developed, and what's the progress on that?
Chair Mar, we do still have the curriculum. I think staff certainly agrees that working with youth is absolutely important, critical. I mean, we've had these YES conferences. We're planning another youth conference for the coming year. So I think continuing to work with our youth is going to be a huge part of our air quality and climate programs. Specifically to the curriculum, it still is out there. There's a limited interest. I have to tell you, I think teachers these days feel, though, there's a lot of demands on their curriculum, how many hours they have in a day to teach all the things that they need to teach. And so I think one of the interesting takeaways that I got last week when we heard the presentation on the curriculum was that what got Kyoto USA in the door, what got the conversation with the school administrators was saving money. That's what they were interested in. If this pencils out, then I'm interested in this project. But then I think we saw several examples where when those panels were then built, we saw other benefits, such as this, the students saw it, they thought it was cool, they became engaged, they wanted to know more about it. So I think we'll have to look at different approaches, all sorts of different approaches that we can to engage with youth.
Great. Director Weigert, connect.
No,
Director Haggerty.
Yeah, maybe what the Air District should do is instead of, since we have the Kyoto Accord, maybe what we should do is establish the California Accord, and we should just stay the course. I mean, I really doubt we're going to start mining coal here in California. So maybe we should just take the leadership and we should stay the course and we can start that. I mean, we can continue to work with the fourth graders and whatever they want to do in the rest of the nation. I doubt we're going to change. I doubt we're going to quit buying hybrids. And I doubt that we all are going to change our thinking that believe that it's no longer climate change, that it is really just the weather. So, we stay the course. We don't change our mentality. You know, I spoke to a group of high school kids the other day, and I told them, I said, I said to them, I'm not really concerned about your children. I'm concerned about your children's children. I really am concerned about the children's children. They are really going to see the brunt of this if we don't change the way we do things today. And I think that we do need to continue the track that we're on, and we need to continue to do what we're doing. And if that's as California standing up, and is this Air District taking the leadership role and pushing back on what the president wants to do, then this leadership or this Air District should show the leadership. It's that simple. We've shown leadership before.
Director Groom.
Thank you. I will continue this conversation. I think almost every county now that we serve is either fully engaged in a community choice energy program or is about to. And in San Mateo County, we are 70,000 people now delivering 100% renewable and another group of people at 50% renewable. And next year we should be in the whole county. And I know that San Francisco is producing that power now. Marin and Sonoma and Alameda County is close, I believe, Scott. You're close to having your CCE. And it's really fascinating to me the warmth with which these programs have been received, the enthusiasm. And yet in one of the speeches from Washington the other day or from New York, it was, well, we're going to reopen those coal mines. And
clean coal, I think.
Yes, clean coal. But in California, it makes no sense, and it certainly makes no sense in Northern California. And so I think that we do have to continue to take the leadership. And when I saw how many workshops you had, Mr. Hilken, maybe we should – what's the amount of people that attend those workshops, and do we keep in touch with them after they come to one? Do we continue to let them know of progress that we're making?
Yes, we do. The attendance varies a lot from modest to a lot. We do keep in touch with them as best we can. We certainly, anybody that signs in, we keep on our distribution list, and we send them email blasts whenever we have a new document or progress to report.
Good. Because I think that's the way we're going to continue this, is not just through the Air Board, but all of the work that we're doing in our own counties.
Any other comments? Thank you so much, Mr. Hilken. Thank you. We have two more presentations before wrapping up our meeting. Number 7, ongoing community grant project status and report on first round of proposed community science partnership projects for fiscal year 2017.
Yes, Chair Maher and members of the Executive Committee. At your last meeting, there was discussion and forwarding on of the grant guidelines for our community science grants for this round of our community grant program. And at that committee meeting, y'all asked for us to give a status report on the grants that were awarded last year and also progress on the applications we're receiving for the community science grants. So David Ralston will give the staff report.
Thank you, Mr. Ralston.
Thank you, Jean. excuse me. Good morning, Chair Maher and members of the committee. David Ralston, Community Engagement. So I will try and go through this presentation fairly straightforward. As you all know, we came September 19th to get direction from the Executive Committee and the Board on our community grant program. And at that meeting, you all asked for a status update on some of our current projects and then preliminary results of projects that we are now looking at before we go to award. So this slide right here shows you the various logos of some of the groups that we are funding right now. There's about 10 groups representing 6 different counties that we are funding. And these projects engage in activities that range from implementing local air pollution mitigation projects such as targeted tree planting. We have 2 of those projects. We have projects that are doing community bike build events and education initiatives, 2 of those projects. And 5 projects that are conducting surveys, collecting air quality research in neighborhoods around schools, doing peer-to-peer training and learning, and developing leadership. And I will go through these in a minute. I also want to especially highlight the work of our staff, Ivana Caceres, who's been really doing the heavy lifting, connecting with these groups. Thank you, Ivana. A lot of exciting projects, and especially as your conversation just alluded to, we are trying to get all of these representatives, to the extent they involve young people, to come to our YES conference on February 25th in the Metro Center. So I'll go through some of the 10 projects real quickly. So Rose Foundation, they are doing a growing justice project in Oakland, in North Oakland. And this is one project where they're working with the Amelia Zapata Academy, planting trees within the school and within the neighborhood, connecting to their curriculum, educating students, and they are well underway on planting trees on the school. They planted 7 trees, and they're doing 28 more in their neighborhood. Earth Team, working with Richmond High and Skyline High School. This is a project that they're doing transportation action project, calculating vehicle mile travel, vehicle VMTs and CO2 emissions around their school. And this is kind of an integrated project with the curriculum and the students. Students are receiving training. 20 classes are coordinated with teachers at these 2 high schools and the Health Academy and Green Energy Academy. San Francisco Bicycle Coalition. This is one of our exciting bike build projects. So working in the Tenderloin and Bayview Hunters Point, the Bicycle Coalition has done these bike builds with residents, education around bike safety, giving away helmets and locks and encouraging people to use bicycles as alternate means of transportation. They had a bike build in March with Casa Justa Just Cause in Bayview with 18 attendees. And in April, they partnered with the Vietnamese Youth Development Center in Tenderloin. Rails to Trails, another one of our bike projects. This is in Richmond in the Iron Triangle. Rails to Trails partnered with Rich City Rides, which is a local bicycle group, bicycle shop on McDonald Avenue. They've done a couple community bike rides, again, working with the high schools, working with the youth, encouraging people to use bicycles as alternate means of transportation. Hunters Point family and Bayview Hunters Point, this is a project that is involving planting, replanting an orchard on the hill and planting 300 biofilters that they will hand out in the neighborhood to help reduce indoor air pollution. They're working with 14 youth from the Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood, also connecting with job readiness curriculum with the Roots to Success program. La Clinica de la Raza in Pittsburgh. This is a program where they're training local promotores, community leaders, to talk about air quality and the use of air filters, air monitors. They're working with the Freedom Breathers in Pittsburgh. And they've started training and working with the promotores and doing outreach in the Pittsburgh community. And they will start attending neighborhood meetings and representing the city of Pittsburgh to advocate for air quality projects. Eco to School Santa Rosa.
One of our youth speakers from the Climate Forward Conference, I think, came from.
That's right, yeah. Thank you for that. Eco to School, this is in three schools in the Santa Rosa area, Roseland University Prep, Sonoma Valley, and Maria Carrillo School. So again, setting up clubs at the schools to develop, tie in with the curriculum, develop education components around what kind of behavior activities to reduce idling, reduce driving, get more people biking, doing field trip leadership development. These three clubs at the school have been meeting, active, really developing a fine cadre of student leaders, as you've seen, who've come to these conferences in the past, and we expect in this coming up year. And we also have other projects that we're still working with to get reports, and one project. One project did withdraw because of lack of capacity. So those are the 10 projects that we have going on right now in this current year. We're very excited, like I said, and we expect and we invite the applicants to come before the board and highlight their work when they're completed at the end of the fiscal year next year. So look forward to that. So next I will talk about our current year's projects. And as you know, this year we're focusing on community science projects, and we put out a call for projects in early October. We've done a lot of extensive outreach. We had an informational workshop on the grants on October 20th, and we received numerous applications to date. Four of these projects, we have formal proposals submitted, and two of them we're scoping for contracts right now. About three other projects we're in discussion with, and you're going to hear from some of the people today to develop these projects. And then we've also heard from another three or four projects that we're also interested in, as well as numerous teachers who want to apply for our small grant teacher award. So this chart that you can see in your packet highlights some of the projects that we are looking at right now. In East Oakland, we're looking to do a air study along the industrial corridor on the San Leandro Boulevard with UC Davis as a principal investigator with the Crocker Nuclear Lab. They have a drum sampler technology, and this will be partnered with local community groups and schools in East Oakland. Bayview Hunters Point, we're working with Rafiki Wellness, with Green Action, and with Literacy for Environmental Justice to do a community air study and kind of hidden hazard study. Also have a partner with San Francisco State, sorry. And in San Jose, we received an application from Green Ninja Program in concert with San Jose State University, working with the Next Generation curriculum and working with the East Side Alliance of San Jose and various schools. So that's the first chart of current projects that you can see. We also have one with the U.S. EPA and Brookfield School to do a vegetative buffer project along the 880 freeway in East Oakland as well. And then these are some other grant projects, proposals that are in review that we're looking at right now. Richmond, we have a proposal from UC Berkeley to work with the RISE organization, youth organization in Richmond, to look at community community health in the Iron Triangle. An exciting project from San Leandro with the CANSTAT program at Magnitude IO to look at GHGs and pollutants with a weather balloon that can go up to 100,000 feet and engage the students at San Leandro High School with that. We also had a proposal from East Palo Alto to look at traffic monitoring in San Mateo County. And like I said, we have other projects that we're also looking at that range from Sonoma County, trying to measure agriculture burn and the effects of that. Teachers from Pittsburgh and Martinez. So this is kind of the broad gamut of projects that we've received. And like I said, we're very excited to start working with these projects, and we look to hopefully get some contracts started at the beginning of the next year and start these projects. That concludes the report. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you. Director Haggerty?
Are these for, what is the criteria for the grant?
For which grant? The new community science grants?
Yeah. Is it primarily for low-income communities, or
no? Or
is there a target on that, or it seems like that's the target you're hitting right now?
Well, there was an explicit target with the whole grant program. We do emphasize projects that are in care communities, that are communities that are already have high impact of air pollution. This community grant program was open to the whole region, and like I said, we have projects from Sonoma County coming in, all across the area. So that wasn't explicit.
Do you have anything coming in from like the Livermore area, which is
we haven't received
the application. Have we outreached to that area at all?
We have outreached, and we've outreached to all the board of directors and e-blasts and press releases.
Could I get some more information on this grant so I can get it out to the Livermore School, because you know I got the lab there, and to me it seems like the lab would love to partner with, you know, that area because of the proximity to the exceedance of the 8-hour ozone standard and things like that. It seems like that they could partner with one of the middle schools or something and do something pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So you know, I'd like to get that out to the school district.
Definitely.
Sure. Thank you. If you could get that to
thank you,
Erica. Thank you.
So we have some public comment too, I believe. Ms. Hrotzka, please call the cards.
I have Ted Tagami and Dr. Tompkins.
Thank you. Yeah, please come forward. 3 minutes per person.
Thank you, Chairman Ma and the Executive Committee. Thank you, David, for inviting us to come out and speak with you guys today. So my name is Ted Tagami. I'm here with my co-founder, Tony So, and I represent a company called Magnitude.io. And we're working with something called the Next Generation Science Standards. And our concerns about our new president-elect and what's happening with climate change, I think, will impact us all. And fortunately for us, we have the Next Generation Science Standards, which the state of California has adopted and is deploying. Expect to see that curriculum in classrooms in 2018 and 2019. California, along with 23 other states, are implementing those standards. What I love about these standards, and we've been working on them for the last 3 years, is your disciplinary core ideas. There's three pillars. Your disciplinary core ideas are what you'd expect to find in a textbook. Cross-cutting concepts, which takes and looks at science across a broad swath of criteria, And then what I'm really endeared with is the integration of science and engineering practice. And so what Tony and I have been able to do with Magnitude over the last 3 years is actually bring science and engineering practice directly into the classroom. And we do that through an instrument called the CANSAT, which was actually developed at Stanford back in the late 90s by Professor Bob Twiggs, who just the next year invented the modern satellite, the 4-inch cube that most startups use today to actually put something in low Earth orbit. These simulated satellites measure the world around you, and students directly in class, whether it's a chemistry class or a physics class or a life science class, investigate the world through phenomenon. And so you lead with the phenomenon first. What's air pressure? What's the relationship between temperature and humidity? What's CO2, and how does that affect us? If we look at these new standards, we have an amazing opportunity, and something I think our current, the upcoming administration will not be able to roll back. It's already being implemented to encourage our youth, K through 12, and beyond, to understand their role in the world. And specifically, there's some very exact criteria in the standards that address human impact and climate change. And so our application is to, we work with several school districts in Northern California. We reach about 70,000 students during the regular school day. And we do these experiments with these CANSATs, and we culminate the event at the end of the semester, at the end of the year, by launching a high-altitude balloon. And in addition to that visceral experience of the students gathering around and understanding the instruments they're about to send aloft, three times higher than a commercial airliner, they're measuring real-world phenomena. Now, these are consumer-grade instruments, so if you look at the R squared, it's like 0.6, you know, so it's not the instruments you're using here at the Air Quality Board. But regardless, I think the students, when they get that data back, begin looking and realizing the opportunities that they have. So CO2, CO, NOx, all of these instruments. And we're working with the San Leandro Unified School District, Barbara Lee Center for Health and Wellness, along with Sequoia Foundation, our grant proposal. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Tagami. Yeah, what an amazing direct use of science. And then you said the new standards go into effect 2018, 2019.
Yeah, they're being rolled out now. And so there are districts that are enabling this. Our plan has been for the last 3 years to meet those standards. It's developing this the pedagogy and the efficacy that's required to make sure it's in the classrooms. And so we're encouraged to work with other school districts as well, but we're focused right now with San Leandro.
And then Mr. Ralston mentioned San Leandro High. What are the other potential high schools in Alameda County that you're looking at?
Oh, so we've done work with Berkeley Unified School District. We generally work at the district level, again, because there's a curriculum that's involved. And when you work with the superintendent, you're able to get that rolled out in a much broader way. And then a lot of our work actually is in San Joaquin County. So it's outside the district here, and that's why we're focusing on the San Leandro Unified.
And then the weather balloons that Mr. Ralston mentioned, that's the simulated satellite, or that acts as a...
Right, so the instrument is actually based on a small microcontroller with a number of instruments. The students will actually construct and think about different experiments they'd want to run. We have a basic platform that they begin building that on. And that does launch in a high-altitude weather balloon, usually directly from the campus with clearance from the FAA.
Wow. Yeah. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak.
Next speaker, Dr. Tompkins.
Good morning, directors. My name is Dr. Raymond Tompkins, and I have a couple things to pass. Could you pass these out to them? Okay. The project that I'll be working on, could you flip back to the potential candidates? Thank you. That one right there. There you go. We're a conglomerate of two other community-based organizations, Green Action and Literacy for the Environment. I will be the principal investigator. I've done research in the past with Dr. Palmer on VOCs in Bayview in the 90s. Actually, 98 is when we did it under the CUREC and EPA grant and the university joint effort. We'll be using particulate counters to search out hot spots. And you have a spot check that I conducted on October the 1st in Bayview Hunters Point showing two particular areas, and I shared that with the Air District and the staff. And we've been working, Rafiki, we've been working with the Air District staff for over going on four years now, trying to develop policy for San Francisco Health Department. And I work with Dr. Martin. See, we're always on first name basis. But Dr. Martin and other members of the staff, in terms, because our objective is that we do a bona fide 100% scientific study in conjunction with the Air District, that we coordinate our tables, that we coordinate the instruments and the timetables, and when do we do our air studies, so that then later the final product will be presented to the board, to the directors, and recommendations of how to clean up the particulates and deal with the reduction. Right now, as previous speaker said, Bayview is a care zone. Speaking with Dr. Tomas Aragon, chief physician for the health department, the highest levels of cardiovascular disease and pulmonary disease is in Bayview, Hunters Point. Out of the 11 districts, Bayview is number one. Wish it wasn't the case. Also, in your study that you did in 2014, residents in the 94124 lived 14 years less than if they lived in Russian Hill. We can change this. It is our objective to, for the first time, to plot out, find out where it is, and then work together. And that's something that I would plead with the board also in terms of public relations, because 50,000 on the ground is not going to cover this, but utilizing your public relations division and explaining to the public what we can and can't do. Science does not have all the answers. And we need to let the public know if we're talking about behavior modification as well in individuals so that we can change this. Also, on my own, I went over to the San Francisco Unified School District. They are very interested in participating. They're talking about even setting up summer school and also training teachers in the level. So Dr. Palmer and I will be doing joint educational training of faculty and parents, because it takes two to make a baby. Then it takes two to educate the child as well. And in the article on the Chronicle, that's when I was at UC Berkeley, and it was a requirement that the parents, I wrote out a textbook for the parents.
So Dr. Tomlins, I'm going to ask you to try to wrap up.
Okay. I thank you for giving me the time. So I hope that you will fund the project. I've already had preliminary interest from the school district and from the residents as well in terms of getting engaged in this. We're using a state-of-the-art equipment, and as the other scientists, educators, this will be real-time monitors that students, and along with the GPS, that we will have real data that can be utilized by the district. And I hope together as we go forward in educating the public what can be done, and so you don't have the public having false anticipation, and that it may take a while before we can get to the true answers and how we can solve this together. That is our objective, is to solve this together, despite who's elected as president.
Thank you. Can I just say thank you for including Green Action? I know they helped with a tour of the Lennar Candlestick Point facility, and Literacy for Environmental Justice, with a strong history with engaging young people, leadership. This is a phase one study, and I'm realizing that it's the hidden hazard study. What's the broader scope of what you're trying to do?
One, in the first phase, to point out the particulate hotspots within the community, Dr. Palmer will be doing VOC studies to deal with what is this made up of for VOCs, and then later working also, we've chit-chatted with UC Davis and their analytical chemists, to then do a further follow-up as to the heavy metals and where, so that we can know where the sources are at, so that finally the board and staff can say what can be done, where the sources, what we can correct, and what we can't correct. And maybe as technology advances, we could make some changes. But to do some things now, if we reduce the particulates, I can guarantee, because right now at Carver Elementary School, 85% of the children in the first grade are asthmatic. If we can reduce the particulates, the babies will be able to attend class at a much more regular basis.
And I know the indoor air quality work with the school district to the air district is a key part of that, but it sounds like you're really trying to put technology in the hands of young people and parents and others to be able to find those hidden hazards and to be empowered in that process.
I hope to, as we kind of use the phrase, demystify science so people can understand it and utilize it in their everyday life to improve the quality of life.
Thank you so much, Dr. Tompkins.
Thank you for listening to me.
Mr. Ralston, any other wrap-up? Oh, any comments, colleagues? Then Mr. Ralston, I don't see Scott here. Mr. Ralston, anything else? No. Thank you. Really great presentation. I love the photos and the visuals as well. Thank you. Thank you. Next item is item 8, update on My Air Online program.
Good morning, Chair Mayor, members of the committee. This morning, Jamie Williams will be giving you our latest update on our efforts to harness our own technology to bring our permitting program up to modern standards. And we've got, quite a good deal of progress to report this morning. So we're feeling pretty good about the status update.
Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Chair Mar, and members of the Executive Committee. I'm going to give just a quick brief update on the My Air Online program and progress that we've made so far in the 2016 calendar year. So just to remind you of our goals for this year, really three areas that we're focusing on are small sources and getting them migrated into our new online system. These represent about 70% of all of our facilities. We have about 11,000 permitted and registered facilities in the Bay Area. And it's primarily made up of small businesses. So that's auto bodies, dry cleaners, gas stations, smaller register sources. And the large group we've been focused on is our diesel backup generators. So we're happy to report that we've completed all the functionality for that. We're in the process of moving all these facilities over as their annual renewals clean up and finish up. We've also been looking at consolidating some of our initial systems to support online small sources. As well as providing support for asbestos job permits, so the renovation and demolition work. For winter spare the air season, we're working with the Compliance and Enforcement Division to roll out some new features to support wood smoke inspections. And that's a combination of really three things. One is an online wizard, new online wizard, so people will be able to submit wood smoke complaints through the web and also on mobile devices. We have field investigation, task assignment, and dashboards. So this is for all of our inspectors to prioritize and manage their work. New exemption management for those that do apply for exemptions and are eligible, as well as the violation processing. And we've really taken this as an opportunity, as a model, to build out support for these processes for the remainders of our programs. So I have just a couple of screenshots I'll show you. This is our online wood smoke complaint wizard. This will be a model for our new online wizard for all air quality complaints. It is what we call responsive, so people can access it using their smartphone, but also on a desktop computer. We've tried to simplify things as much as possible, collect just the information that we need from the public, and that would get routed right away to internal staff. We have new investigation forms, so it's previously rolled out with the move to the new building. All of our inspectors have been given new Microsoft Surface tablet computers. So we've redesigned the inspection forms to be touch-friendly. Again, very similarly, easier to navigate and to collect only the information that's necessary. This will enable field staff to collect information in the field and have it automatically routed back to their supervisors for review and approval. And they can pass the work back and forth, attach documents, pictures, all the evidence that's needed if there is a violation or an issue that needs to be processed. So we've revamped our dashboards for the inspectors and supervisors, really pointing out key metrics and key categories of work that need to be focused on. And again, this will be a model for our other programs, including asbestos, all air quality complaints, and other facility inspection work. So as I also mentioned, we've finished up work on our asbestos renovation and demolition process. So we can now accept job requests online, submit accept online payments, as well as handle the staff review and approval. So all of this was mostly done on paper. We had online payment, but we're really looking at completing the process. And much of the work that I've presented to you before, as far as our online permitting process for sources, we've applied really the similar layout and methodology. So you can see here some of the screenshots. We've broken down the asbestos job request process down into six steps. It looks very similar to our permitting process, and that is available. We have internal dashboards for staff to review jobs and approve them, and that includes supervisor and payments. Everything is included in that. So as far as what's next, we're going to complete the consolidation of our registered sources. We are in the process of expanding usage of the system for all of our engineering division and compliance enforcement division. So we will be piloting this wood smoke functionality with compliance enforcement later this Spare the Air season, and rolling out, coordinating the training and rollout of the asbestos program. And then another thing we've been focusing on is developing an online growth plan. So not just putting the software out there and expecting people to use it. So how are we going to actually promote use of the online system and actually encourage people to do that? So we're working on implementing that. Some of the remaining activities we'll be working on this calendar year. So expanding functionality for all of our field inspections, so facility inspections, all 11,000 facilities and how we collect that information, compliance information. Revamping our complaint and dispatching and investigation process, and also handling of enforcement actions. So this would be notices of violations and notices to comply. And in 2017, we'll be working on the remaining 30%. So this is really where we get into a lot of the details of the more complex facilities, and which we call our complex facility plan. So this includes modifying our renewal process and streamlining how we get information, especially from our larger facilities, including refineries. So one sort of user interface might be easy if you have one or two pieces of equipment, but if you have hundreds, we want to figure out how we can facilitate getting that information efficiently and how we can review and approve that. It also falls in line with our new regulations, 1215, with our refinery inventory tracking, as well as some of the work that we'll be doing around 1118 for toxics and capturing information for health risk assessments. That will be coming up for review and approval adoption later next year. So as far as progress on this, we've been meeting with the refineries approximately every 2 weeks to discuss, and this is in line, as I mentioned, with Regulation 1215, really the format and the content of electronic data submittal. So this is their annual report that they're going to be submitting, which we will be building new inventories and making some of those inventories, portions of the inventory will be public. We're also reviewing the modeling parameters, as I mentioned, for the health risk assessments that will be part of 1118, so we can capture that information electronically, and really developing sort of our backlog of features that we're going to use to scale the system to handle these more complex sources. One of the things we're going to be doing is tying our renewal process in with 1215. So as it stands right now, the refineries are required to report every year in which we calculate their emissions and we bill them. We have separate regulation 1215 where they're submitting information electronically for building an inventory. We want to merge those two together. So that's a plan that we have really over the next 2 years to make our processes more efficient. And with that, quick update, no action items on this, but happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Williams. I see no questions. Let's open this up for public comment. Anyone?
I'll just mention, Mr. Chairman, we have had other folks interested in our system. So we had South Coast come up here, Jamie, about, what was that, a few weeks ago, 3 or 4 weeks ago. Yeah. And Jamie and Damien demoed the system for them, and they're extremely impressed and want to be able to just take it and put it in South Coast. That's not as simple as they might like to think, because we'd like to talk to them about, you know, getting some reimbursement for the years and years of work that we put into this. So I thought I would just mention that to you because there's other folks looking at the system now and also wanting to adopt it.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Let's see. I think we only have one more item, committee member comments and other business. Any comments? Looks like I'll just say there's one other board of directors meeting December 7th, and then three scheduled December committee meetings so far. But thank you so much. I think, is there any other business before us, Ms. Rodzka?
December 7th, there's a board meeting, a full board meeting. I did want to mention, Mr. Chairman, that if you look at the rest of this week, we believe it's going to be inclement weather. So we don't think this is going to be a spare of the air. Dr. Hudson specifically has asked me that question to make sure we don't have a spare of the air day, but it doesn't look like we will on Thursday.
Great.
Mr. Chair.
Director Haggerty.
Thank you. Just because this is probably your last executive committee, and I'll probably maybe say something at the board of directors, but I just want to say that you've been an outstanding chair, and you've gotten us through some very difficult times, but I've really enjoyed your chairmanship and your leadership this past year, and I sincerely mean that.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. With that, meeting adjourned. Thank you.